You want to
Hello,
take it from
welcome
the top?
everyone. My name is Arzu Mohseni, and it's a great pleasure welcoming to the New York Public Library the prolific artist and academic Archie Rand, who is the Presidential Professor of Art at Brooklyn College, and the influential social critic and scholar Camille Paglia, who is the University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. She's the author of 6 books, including her recent volume titled Glittering Images, A Journey Through Art from Egypt to Star Wars. We are here tonight to inaugurate and celebrate Archie Rand's new book titled The 613 with a discussion and a book signing. Archie Rand's career as an artist spans 5 decades with myriad themes and genres. Among his pioneering explorations, The 613 is his most ambitious achievement. Without knowing where the work would be exhibited or published, he began transforming each and every mitzvah or commandment into its own breathtaking painting. The series took 5 years to complete. Each of the perplexing panels features a vibrant, unexpected image that brings forth the heart of its law and commands our eyes to linger. Whether grotesque or dramatic, the paintings provoke a sense of wonder and self-reflection, making The 613 a book to be revisited many times. Perfect for readers of art, popular visual culture, or religion, The 613 may prove to be the most audacious and distinctive book of its kind. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Artist Dialogue Series event, providing an open forum since 2004 for appreciation and understanding of contemporary art. Many of you have already purchased copies of The 613. I believe there are only 5 or 6 copies left, and they will be available for purchase at the end of the event. Archie Rand will be autographing copies of The 613 at the end of the event in the corridor adjacent to the auditorium. I also like to invite many of you to, actually everyone here in the audience, to visit the art collection located at Mid-Manhattan Library at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can freely and openly browse the largest circulating collection of books and videos covering every aspect of art, art criticism, and history. Thank you so much for coming out tonight, and it's now time to turn the floor to Archie Rand and Camille Paglia.
Well, first of all, Archie, I want to congratulate you on this spectacular achievement. Blue Rider Press has done a magnificent job, okay, with this book. This is just a beautifully printed book, but I am so disaffected, okay, from contemporary art. Derivative, boring, pretentious, superficial, okay? Every image in this book, it's like over 600 images, has such dynamism, okay, has such graphic energy, has such imagination, takes in the whole, you know, the history of the arts, the high arts with the popular arts. This is, I think, just a landmark book, and I'm delighted to be here with you tonight.
thank you very much. It's a great honor for me to share the stage with you as well. I'm a longtime fan. You're one of the, I mean, we're just going to schmooze for 2 seconds here. But Camille Paglia is one of the great maverick intellectuals, and it's a loss to our culture, in fact, that there aren't a lot more colleagues aside from her. But she stands alone as a very clear and articulate voice, and I'm very honored to be on the stage with Camille.
Well, let me ask you, okay, in terms of, let's just begin with your earliest years. What drew you, okay, to the visual arts, and what do you feel were the most formative influences on you?
My father worked retail. He worked 6 days a week. He left the house at 8 o'clock in the morning, came home at 10, and he was home on Sundays, and he was a flautist. He was in the Philharmonic, fourth flute, and when the Depression came, they cut the orchestra from 110 to 55 people. He was out of a job in his early 20s. And he painted on Sundays, or he would take us to concerts or museums or read books to us or play flute. And if I wanted to be with my father, he would go downstairs to the basement and he would paint, and I would be 3-4 years old and I'd hang out and watch him. And eventually he would smear some paint on a piece of masonite and give me a brush and let me hang out with him. And that was that was a way of gaining a certain kind of rapport and affection with my father, who later taught me a lot about painting. He was a fairly good amateur painter. So by the time I got into kindergarten, the teachers knew that if they wanted to keep me out of trouble, they should put me at the easel. They sort of figured that out. I was a troublemaking kid. And I spent, you know, the rest of my elementary, junior, high school, and high school years being put at the easel by the teacher to keep out of trouble.
So did you have a sense of the street? There's a kind of a street energy in your work, at least in this book.
I grew up in Bensonhurst, which was the home of a lot of gangs and a lot of Dion and the Belmonts type doo-wop groups. The Mystics and the Passions used to practice quite near the house. In fact, I sang in high school with the brother of Joey Gallagher and the Passions. We used to sing doo-wop in the stairways when we were cutting class. And there's a lot of Brooklyn that you sort of can't take out of the Brooklyn kids, you know. So there is, I mean, if you came from Brooklyn at that time, you were a street kid. It played stickball, the whole thing.
And then later, jazz became, and was this much later, or?
No, jazz actually saved my life. I was of that age when, I must have been 5, 6, 7 years old, when Little Richard and Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry hit the airwaves, or hit the jukeboxes at the time, and I was enamored with that. And by about 1960 or 61, once they started importing that Frankie Avalon sound from Chancellor Records in Philadelphia, I became really disgusted. They had killed my music. And at that time, hard bop was very much in the air. And I came from a very musical neighborhood. The saxophonist Dave Liebman went to my high school. Mike Garson, who later worked with David Bowie, but was working with Stan Getz. It was Joel Peskin. A lot of musicians came from the neighborhood who were friends of mine. Teddy DiColo. I could rattle off a whole bunch of them. And at that time, it was easier to fall into the hard bop crowd. It was a leftover of the beatnik identity. So I was already formed as kind of like a teenage old man. I was a hard bop beatnik guy. At the time when all my friends were becoming hippies, I was filled with disgust. I was, psychologically, the previous generation.
Yeah. And what about dance? I mean, because it seems to me that your images have such a choreography. There's a kind of gesturalism that I think is absolutely phenomenal. Okay, the energy of the body going in every different direction, all kinds of vectors of it. Well, do you have what kind of a contact with dance did you have?
I wish I could take credit for that. Basically, a lot of these images are swiped from people whom I admired, mostly the artists from Mad Magazine or the EC Comics. As far as dance is concerned, one of my earliest friends and mentors, who's a friend to this day, is the pianist and composer Cecil Taylor. And Cecil worked very closely with dance, and I never thought of it until you just brought it up, but Cecil's rhythms, in fact, work very closely. He worked very closely with Baryshnikov, for instance. And in fact, he told me a story. It's funny you should bring this up, it never even occurred to me, that he was working with Baryshnikov and some prima ballerina, whose name is famous, but I actually forgot who it was. And the ballerina stopped dancing, and Baryshnikov had brought Cecil with him. And he said, I can't work with this musician. He's not, you know, I can't count time to his music. And Baryshnikov says, at this stage of the game, if you have to count time, you don't belong to be dancing with, you don't deserve to be dancing with me. And, you know, Cecil had that kind of continually relentless propulsion rhythm. And I guess that goes with being a street kid. I was attracted to those movements and those images because I'll be through in a second. when you go to art school, you get all these static poses. You know, you get like, yeah. And you wonder after you draw that what you're supposed to do with somebody in that position. And you see a lot of hapless painters trying to actually do something out of it. Like there'll be a street scene with a bus and there's a stop sign and a trash can and somebody in a business suit is going. And you figure, what's that supposed to mean, you know? So I was disgusted with what I learned in the academic circles, and I gravitated along with every single person my age who wanted to be an artist towards the EC Comics and Mad Magazine, which were incredibly influential, much more so than has been documented. Those guys were amazing, and I just swiped half the book from those guys.
And what about the movies? Because it seems to me that there's an awful lot of, there's a kind of film noir glamour to the women of your images.
Yeah, that also comes from the EC artists appropriating the film noir images into their comic book style. But I thought about it for about a year. The color is tremendously influenced by the Technicolor that I saw as a kid. You know, you go to the movies every Saturday, and you'd be watching, you know, things like The Robe, you know, and the color was nuts. Every man with black hair had blue highlights. It was no, really, it was incredible. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was fascinated by the extreme color of those things,
right.
And stayed with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, do you have any favorite movies of that period that you actually, the movies themselves?
No, I unfortunately I don't know how much expertise I can claim in other cultural forms. I listen to a lot of jazz. I read a lot of poetry. I see less movies because they take up too much time. Although I don't find that with reading. I don't know why I give that sentence to movies. But I enjoy movies. I just don't watch them very often.
Yeah. I ask because as a Hitchcock maven,
right.
I saw the great image in North by Northwest of Cary Grant
running with the plane.
Yes,
yeah.
Isn't that an homage to that?
Yeah, I believe that may have come from a Will Elder drawing in probably Mad Magazine, which was a spoof on that very Hitchcock scene.
Okay.
There was a lot of movie spoofs and. Mad in the 1950s was totally nuts, and they would spoof everything. And you know, half of the things that you see in the book that are parodies that are somehow very ill-fittingly joined up with the biblical commandments are in fact dragged screaming and kicking unwillingly from Mad Magazine to line up with the Bible.
Yeah, I would say that Mad Magazine was a big influence on me as well.
There you go.
I love what you say in the introduction where you say that the images of this book are comic but not ironic.
Yes.
Could you expand on that?
Wow, now we're getting into
That's
the
great.
Deep of it. One of the things that I found that disgusted me in academia, the subject I thought we'd get to later, but you hit on it now, is that like any bureaucracy, it became more and more centralized and therefore more and more inflexible to the point where academia became almost a useless factory that people were sort of fed into and spit out because they knew that their degree was necessary. Mm-hmm. And as little room for, the problem is imagination would mess up the rhythm of that bureaucracy. So imagination was curtailed from that. And one of the things that was bumped out of that conversation as being too dicey was anything that was sexual. And anything that was religious. And I just got tired of that. And I realized also that in the art world, those things were kept out of place also. With all the pornography that's available, either on the internet or even in stores, it's remarkable how much flack Jeff Koons got for his Made in Heaven show. And I thought, isn't this kind of hypocritical in a way? I mean, this stuff is all around. I mean, not that I'm supporting Jeff Koons, but like, you know, give the guy a break. I mean, he just tried to do something dorky about that. You know, and you bring up religion, and you have, as you'd mentioned before, people like, you know, Chris Ofili or Andre Serrano, you know, getting hit. And the amount of targeting that this stuff gets is way out of proportion to the amount of democracy that should be allowed in what's supposedly an open discourse. And I realized that the discourse was not only not open, but it was almost fascistically closed. And you know, I was just reading, actually on your recommendation, I was reading Milton Kessler, the poet, and Kessler has a line that says something like, all musicians share the same obscurity. Give up and pick up your horn. And I thought, wow, that's a great line. It's kind of like, I got nothing to lose. I've had like 120 solo shows. You know, the art world can do whatever it wants. Let's do something that really goes to the heart, not only of the aesthetics in the art world, but the aesthetics in the increasingly insular and bureaucratic Jewish religion, which is flailing desperately to keep itself afloat in different factions. So that's what this book is a response to in terms of its courting religious imagery.
Well, I think that, you know, the overall vision that you and I share is this sense of shock and despair, okay, at the absence of a spiritual vision in the arts. And to me, as an atheist, okay, you cannot just like wipe out all all established beliefs without offering young people something in his place. And so if you deny God and deny religion, then you should have art and belief in art. And instead, the art world has been taken over by this, by, you know, a paralytic, self-destructive irony. Okay, the tone of postmodernists and post-structuralists, okay, it's absolutely toxic, okay? And that graduate students are being trained in this ironic tone. That's how you show you're sophisticated, right? That's why I love the idea of being comic without being ironic, even though I'm a great admirer of the great ironists, Oscar Wilde, you know, Pope, okay, Dorothy Parker. I mean, you can go on and on, okay? There's like, there's such a tradition of satire with a truly an energetic and healing kind of an incisive sort of a satire. But what I see in the art world, okay, are these like very small desiccated poses. I think that this is a tremendous contribution, you know, to the discussion, because these energies, they're almost like cosmic energies that are just bursting, you know, from your images. Now, I'm not sure whether what your belief system is in terms of you feel clearly culturally Jewish, as I feel culturally Italian Catholic. Okay, the church will always remain, my grounding. Okay, in my life, but I don't believe in a personal God, but I do believe in the spiritual vision, a metaphysical vision of the universe. Okay, and the smallness of people's political paradigms today, of the Marxist paradigm, which has only to do with society. Okay, this is why the arts have gotten boring. This is why everything's derivative. There's nothing of interest except this. Okay, that's coming out of the contemporary arts, precisely because, okay, of this absence of the large cosmic, you know, vision that my generation of the 1960s had. Now, my explanation for this, is that the seekers, the true spiritual questers of the 1960s, took themselves out of the running, okay, by pickling their brains, okay, on acid. Now, I miraculously, okay, coming from a wine culture, Italian wine culture, did not partake of the LSD, okay? So I am like, I feel like I'm on the last. I see everyone falling all around me, okay? And that's why I seem so odd and unique. But in point of fact, there was an entire generation of spiritual seekers, okay, whose brains didn't survive long enough to make the contributions, okay, to preserve spirituality in art.
Well, I find that, you know, since we grew up at about the same time, that I was, you know, formed, as the cliche goes, in the crucible of the 60s, and the moral leaders, the people who pervade ethics to the entire culture. On the right, you had Billy Graham, but on the left, you had Reverend Martin Luther King, Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Father Daniel Berrigan, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, and you had Malcolm X, who was in fact an imam. That is, it wasn't just Malcolm X, you know, Detroit Red out of the prison, which they like to play up. He was a spiritual religious leader. And all of our ethical leaders, in fact, partook in this connection to validating their ethical stance by saying that it came from a spiritual authority. And once that became invalidated by, for lack of a better word, logic, there was nothing that the novelist Elsa Morante said that she couldn't imagine living a life that was bereft of consolation. And one of the things that spirituality, an awful word to use, but it's the only one we've got, provides is you need a receptacle for gratitude. You need a receptacle for hope. Cornel West was talking about how, as an African American, he no longer believed in the notion of faith because faith was reciprocal. It was if there was a fix. That is, if you were good, God would be good to you. And his experience as an African American was that was not the case. But he said that what he finally decided to do was be ethical and be good and then just hope that things would happen, and if they did, they did, and if not, not. But that discourse is too dicey for academia, which basically has been running the curatorial systems and even the gallery systems for many, many years now, and has scotched that element out of aesthetics, which in fact was dominant when people talked about post-war abstraction. They would talk about the sublime in Rothko. If I hear that word another time, I'll go out of my gourd. You know, and they talked about the sublime, making darn sure, bringing up Caspar David Friedrich, you know, that we kept this on somehow a totally theoretical level, that there was a sublime without a spiritual component to it, which of course is nuts, but that's the basis of theory, as if somehow you can extract this and say, well, you know, you can have spirituality, but without any passion, without any commitment, without any emotion, without any psychological attachment to it, just the concept of spirituality, but without any involvement. And of course, that, as you said, it's desiccated. You end up with nothing.
In my generation, people were very interested in Buddhism coming from the beatniks, coming from Gary Snyder, in Hinduism. It was everywhere, okay? The sense of, this searching for meaning, you know, a sense of the largeness of the universe, a sense of our smallness compared to the great forces that are out there. Instead, we have this like incredibly limited tunnel vision view, okay, that obsessively focus on the political. Now, I'm very interested in politics. I'm a political commentator. I read the political news every day. But good Lord, okay, the great human questions are about existence, okay? You yourself have written that. They are far bigger, okay, than any of these tiny political paradigms that people have gotten from Foucault, Derrida, Lacan. I mean, it's absolutely horrible, you know, what's happened. Okay, the soullessness of contemporary education. Okay?
It's amazing. You know, I worked in a number of grad schools. I'm at one now, but I don't want to pick on that any more than I'd pick on, you know, what I saw at Columbia University or Maryland Institute or any other place you go. But there are grad students who are given studios to be 2 years to become artists, and they can lock themselves in the studio and supposedly let their imaginations run free, and they can do that without any kind of portcullis dropping behind them that would keep them from venturing out into the so-called irrational. And you know, then they go to class and they're told to read Immanuel Kant, which is perfectly nice if you're a general student, but you've got 2 years to get your act together, and then they get quizzed on this stuff. And I'm figuring, you know, that's all interesting, but you know, you can have enough Derrida and enough Foucault and enough, you know, I mean, the French philosophers are fascinating, which is great if you're a critic. You know, it's great if you want to put something in context, but if you're a working artist, this will strangle you. So basically, artists are being taught to be their own viewers. And once you're your own viewer, you know, you're as Elaine May said, you're encrusted. Yeah, that's the state that we're in. I made it. I don't know if I wrote it in the introduction or whether I've just said it so many times it's become natural to me. But because of these MA programs and MFA programs, in my opinion, the Whitney Annual hasn't changed in 45 years. Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed at all ever since the inculcation of the necessity of that degree. And I think, well, what's so unusual about that? Well, you think, well, like, you know, in 1890 you have Aubrey Beardsley. And then from like 1900 to 1910, you have Cubism. And like from 1910 to 1920, you have Dada. And from 1920 to 1930, you have Surrealism. Then you have from 1930 to 1940, you have Social Realism. And then these things keep changing, Abstract Expressionism, pop, and it stops dead in the mid-70s when the MA programs become necessary, and nothing's happened since.
That's right.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, in my book, Glittering Images, I say it's because that after Warhol, okay, the avant-garde was dead, and people are going on still believing that the avant-garde lives.
Well,
it doesn't. I mean, it's become an establishment.
Well,
there's no avant-garde without being oppositional.
Okay, even calling it avant-garde, though, puts it into a situation where one has a certain kind of expectation. I'm not even talking about that. I mean, the avant-garde is lovely.
They believe they're avant-garde. That's the folly of it.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is, if you know, look at like what Ezra Pound talks about, what the artist's obligation is. You know, your obligation basically is to record as accurately as possible what it is you're feeling in response, and then transcribing it as articulately as possible. And whether that comes out being avant-garde or simply a sign of its time. See, the problem that you were talking about before, about irony, is that the problem with irony is that it's topical. And because it's topical, it has a very limited shelf life. But the new market is basically a market of people who will relate to the topicality of something. So they're buying art the way they'd buy a 45 RPM record. You know, it's kind of like, oh, I like this song, I can dance to it, and then I'll sell it at Sotheby's next week, you know. So that's basically the new paradigm that we're dealing with. And there's something very scary about the notion of being in a position of defense, because history has shown that if you're in a position of defense, like conservative Republicans, you really haven't got much of a chance because you're defending something that organically is disintegrating. So the argument that we're actually having is one of passion and of love. You know, what we're talking about now is, you know, we could be two old Jews sitting in a cafe on Second Avenue in 1940 over a cup of tea and saying, oh, remember, you know, Emperor Franz Joseph, you know. The things that we're talking about probably won't get reinstigated for a while. You know, we're talking about the difference between Hogarth and Goya. We have a lot of Hogarth out there. There is not only no room for Goya, but Goya is a sort of problem. That is, if Goya were to exist in a modernist context, it would be an annoyance. And, you know, because critically, there'd be no room to accommodate that. There's too much passion involved.
You mentioned this often in the essays I've read of yours about enthusiasm and how enthusiasm is bred out of our present academic system. And I can vouch for that. When I first became known in the early 90s, I'll never forget a letter I received from a woman who was now painting houses in Missouri. Okay? And she said she had been a graduate student in comparative literature at the University of California at Berkeley, and she said that my portrait of the decadence of the graduate schools was exactly right. And she said that she was forced to drop out from it because at seminars, when she would express enthusiasm for what they were reading and examining in the class, people looked at her as if she had created some offense. And I thought, oh my God, the one thing that aspiring teachers need in the classroom, if you're going to teach undergraduates, is enthusiasm. And we have a system, that's the postmodernist, post-structuralist stuff, which is inculcating a detachment, a sense of superiority to the text. I mean, that's this whole style is you go through the text, with a red pen and check in the margin everything that's wrong, with the text, and racism, sexism, homophobia, and then eventually the text, of course, dissolves itself. Okay, it always attacks itself. It's always self-referential. Okay, and by the end you're left with zero. Okay, right? So it's a process of deconstruction that's truly destruction. Okay, that is now everywhere, and it's even in Brazil. Okay, I am fighting a rear guard action in Brazil. Okay, that's why they keep on bringing me down there. Okay, to fight off the seeping deconstruction. Okay, that's coming down.
In a much more insidious way, you have that in the studio programs as well. That is, people don't actually put the pieces together when they recall that the Bauhaus was in fact a National Socialist program. And in fact, what the object was to structure something. I read an anecdote once that Kandinsky and Franz Marc and somebody else were brought into, who was the director? I'm senior moment. And anyhow, three of them were brought into the director's office at the Bauhaus, and I think he was married to Alma Mahler, I forget who it was, and said to the three of them, it's come to my notice that the three of you are doing something, and if you continue to do it, I will fire all three of you. It seems like after curfew, when everyone's supposed to be in bed, students are secretly meeting in your studios and you're teaching them how to paint. And that is forbidden here. We're here to make chairs and cups for the people. Now, that is the basis of the programs that have been instilled into the American academies. So people take for granted that there's such a thing as, oh, it's a foundation course. So freshmen come in and they learn about color and this and that. And then everyone ends up turning out the same kind of art and they wonder why. So in my elementary painting classes, I just stopped teaching the color wheel. The color wheel is a basically recent invention. Watteau and Rembrandt didn't use the color wheel. There's plenty of other, the frescoes of Pompeii aren't using the color wheel. Asian artists don't use it. Why is this color wheel so sacrosanct? And that opens up a lot of things. And then people say, Archie, how do you get that incredible colors out of your class? And you look at the other teachers, and they're all painting like these kind of, gray Fairfield Porter landscapes. And you say, well, they've learned how to do it. There is no how to do it. It's up to the individual. But the notion of individuality, again, is much too difficult for an organized system to deal with. So, when people should be getting, a higher education has gotten smart. And they've realized that since they're necessary, they don't have to do anything. All they have to do is keep you in line, tell you to keep your mouth shut. What's happened is that college has become a place where when you get your degree is a kind of guarantee to your employer that you'll shut your damn mouth, do what you're told. I'm absolutely serious. And you're a good company person, that you're not a troublemaker. You've got a degree from a college. You took 4 years taking crap from somebody. And it's amazing if you actually get an education. And I'm not being overly hysterical about this, because I see what goes on. Now, that doesn't mean you don't get even more than occasional, excellent and enthusiastic instructor. Of course they exist, and thank God they do. But by and large, people just come and punch the clock and go through whatever the syllabus calls for. And the syllabus itself is guilty. I mean, syllabuses should change as it becomes organically necessary, so people see how to think on your feet and how to respond. But that's what's happening now. Now, what that has to do with the 613 is something else. But the 613 is a response to that. It's a response to the kind of animosity, actual hatred, something that you're not unfamiliar with either, that I was faced with after I did these B'nai Yosef murals. In 1974, I did these murals for a synagogue, and I was hanging out with like all these color field guys, these Greenbergian painters. And after about 6 months of everyone knowing I was working on these murals, I'd walk into Finelli, and guys that used to buy me beers would kind of move away. Or, you know, artists a little bit older than me would see me walking down Spring Street and cross the street, rather than have to deal with this. And I realized there's a real antipathy towards what I'm doing. And because I'm from Brooklyn, and because I'm a wise guy, I became more interested in that. Mm-hmm. You know, that is, why is it that these people who are in lockstep with anything Clem said, Clem Greenberg, why is it that they're listening to him? Is it solely for the marketing reasons? Just one more thing. When I started on B'nai Yosef, when I started doing these murals, I sat down with my wife Maria. We were living in a fourth floor walk-up, and I had kids. And I said to myself, how much would I actually be losing in $1974 if I decided to like chuck this whole thing and do what I knew I could do, which was become like, you know, one of the company artists and turn out work that people liked and, you know, keep aware, keep abreast of the changing currents and try to stay one step ahead of the aesthetic. I knew basically I had the manual skills and the psychological skills to do that. I'm not being bragging about this. It's like an athlete knows he can run, you know? I knew I could do that. And I sat down and I said, well, I have this number of shows, you know, maybe this less number of magazine articles, this less number of sales. And in 1974, I came up with a figure of like $2 point something million. And I said, over the course of my life, I would probably be losing $2 point something million. And I remember sitting at the table and saying to Maria, you know, $2 point something million is not enough money to take your whole life and throw it down the toilet for the sake of that. So to hell with it. And, you know, that's what kept my attraction up with this material.
So this issue about religious tradition, okay, as being central to culture, I mean, I'd like to, you know, sort of talk about that, because I'm very concerned about the signs of the collapse of the West, as the West has moved away from its foundational texts and images. And I'll give you an example. It was about 15 years ago already now, okay, when I had a terrible shock, okay, in the classroom. And I'm teaching at an art school. I've taught at art schools for most of my entire career.
Yeah,
you know,
thank
over
God
40
you're
years.
There. Yeah,
yeah. And I have a course called The Art of Song Lyrics. And I, in one of the songs that I conventionally do in it, when we get to a section about Negro spirituals, okay, I do the song "Go Down Moses." And I had taught this for years, really, since the late 1980s. And it was about 15 years ago now. I was teaching, you know, playing. I handed the lyric out. I play a version of it, and then we're going. And I was feeling. I was struggling, and I didn't understand why was I struggling. I didn't understand. It was like very hard going. Everybody seemed like they were like mummies in front of me. And it suddenly hit me, okay, as I was interpreting the lyric, that the class didn't recognize the name Moses. All right, now, okay, when we have young people, young artists, aspiring artists, who don't recognize the name Moses. Okay, what is there left of the Western tradition? What is there left of our civilization? Right, it has nothing to do with religious belief. It has to do, these are foundational images, inspirational, the story of Moses, okay, which relates, you know, in terms of world folklore to all kinds of things, the mysterious birth, you know, the prince who comes from, you know, nothing, you know, from the reeds of the Nile and so on and so forth. There's so many things that to give, in the story of Moses, to give consolation to people who don't believe in God at all, okay? So please tell me what you think about the tradition.
As I said before, you know, things done in the spirit of defense can be very, very disappointing. I gave a lecture to my grad students a month ago. This, again, we're talking about a generational change that's so, it's such a tectonic shift that, you know, we really can't put ourselves in a position of trying to refeed these people what we had affection for. And I stood up in front of the class and I said, I woke up this morning and found I had turned into a cockroach. And nobody moved. And I said, Kafka, anybody? And one guy raised his hand. Figured, okay, now I know what I'm dealing with here. When I was at Columbia, there was a guy who was in the physics department named Sam Devens, who had been there since the 1920s. He was quite a character. And Devens said that he was on a committee in Columbia in the 20s when the classics department had a violent debate to the point of somebody punching somebody else out as to whether or not they should teach Shakespeare in college, because that would place the thing, you know, Homer and the Aeneid and things like that in a second tier. And they finally decided that Shakespeare was not too modern to teach. And they finally allowed Shakespeare into the curriculum. So things do change. The problem that I have is how to take the specific of whether it's Pound or Charlie Parker or Jackson Pollock or whatever, and find if there is something in the current of this global digital generation that is a place for that kind of passionate injection. And that's a tough thing to do. I don't know whether I've hit that or not, but you can try to inject as much as you want and show people things, but
I'm concerned about the loss of knowledge of or even awareness of the distant past. Okay, I find that there's a real shallowness, okay, to the kind of primary education that American students are getting. I mean, just year by year by year, the slippage, okay, that I'm experiencing in the classroom, just as someone who's, the way I teach is like always I'm looking at the people's faces and I can see whether they understand what I'm saying or don't recognize what I'm saying or not. My goodness, the students coming out of, I have a wide range of students at an art school. I have students from good suburban school districts, but a lot of students also from inner city neighborhoods, talented dancers and jazz musicians and so on. So it's a wide range of backgrounds for my students. And I'm finding that they know nothing about world geography, world history, I mean, and their sense of the present is getting more narrower and narrower. Okay.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I picked the 613. Mm-hmm. That is, when you're working religiously, if you work to a textually obedient source, that is, if you're actually saying, well, Moses, then you illustrate it. The illustration becomes a double negative because it's subservient to the word. So I thought what I'd go for, first I started with prayers, which have less of a narrative component. Mm-hmm. And then I decided to go to laws. So basically, this is like illustrating the Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do was go to something so deep in the armature of observant Judaism that it would be attractive because of the imagery, which I thought was contemporary, but then people would find themselves reading things that they never, ever would have read in a lifetime. Many conservative and reformed Jews, in fact, have told me they didn't even know there were 613 commandments. Mm-hmm. This is something that's pretty much within the exclusive realm of Orthodox study. And I thought, let me hit something so deep that it becomes both attractive, silly, and possibly opens up. You know, I'm not saying I did this as an educational thing, because obviously you don't do 700 paintings in your studio because you're trying to make a point. You know, it's like it wasn't a New Yorker cartoon, but it became like there's a large history in art of people doing biblical representation, And I wanted to do something that I saw in one sense was evaporating. And that's where that passion comes in. You know, not that I pertain to the 613 commandments, but it's something that should be made available before the Titanic sinks.
Well, I think that's part of the explosiveness of the book, okay, is that you get this sense of ancient history, okay, and ancient tradition, okay, so you're getting this recording of actual mitzvahs, the actual laws that were imposed, whether they were followed or not, right, and then this tremendous contemporary kind of energy and allusions to popular culture and so on. You just get this the sense of all of history, you know, at once, and your book is a model. It should show young artists of what is possible, okay, to widen the range, okay, of their interests and their investigations, and find something in the distant past to bring up to the present, and so that you get it is literally explosive. What you've achieved.
It thank you. It sort of straddles the notion of identity politics, which I wanted to steer clear of in a way. And one of the things I was asking myself was, if you're an artist who identifies as Jewish, what do you use as your visual roles, considering that Christianity has basically maintained what we have inherited as art in Western culture for the past 2,000 years? And I realized that this whole school revolving around Will Eisner, these comic artists who would not be allowed into the upper echelons, for instance, it's a shame to see what happened to people like Raphael Sawyer, who wanted to be Degas, and like somehow, you know, either an expression of his relative merits or an expression of how he was accepted, that didn't happen. So you had people like who fell off. You had Hyman Bloom and Jack Levine, and they sort of found their own orbit outside of the larger art world. But Will Eisner, the great cartoonist, had this whole stable of crazies working with him in the comic book industry. And the comic book industry was so off the charts of the fine artists that if you came out of an art school and you had these skills and you already made the decision that either you couldn't or you wouldn't seek acceptance in the larger fine art world, the comic book world was a whole other universe you could go into. And what I found was that I could freely take from this language because an enormous percentage of these artists were Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is crazy. These are Jewish artists. You know, we think, like, there's Marc Chagall, and then there's, like, well, then there's Will Eisner, you know. And the answer is, yeah, there's Will Eisner, and there's, like, the spirit. And, I mean, his progeny became people like Stan Lee, who did, you know, Spider-Man, or Jules Pfeiffer, or, you know, he had people like Ben Catchor and Art Spiegelman come out of that Will Elder, who worked as his assistant. Who later ended up in Mad Magazine. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a terrific legacy for me to have had available and to dig into and claim that it's all part of one sort of, you know, trajectory. I don't know.
It's reminding me, you know, Neil Gabler has a wonderful book, you know, an Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood,
right.
Okay, which is really true. I mean, that you know, Jewish immigrants have had enormous impact on our own popular culture.
Yeah, but unlike the Jewish Hollywood moguls or people like Ralph Lauren, who kind of invented an American look, you know, Ralph Ney Lipschitz. The comic book industry never had any pretensions towards you know, double-breasted jackets. It was pretty down and dirty stuff to the point where the American Congress had to put a stop to EC Comics. Mm-hmm. They decided that it should self-regulate, mm-hmm. and Mad Magazine was the last gasp of that, as was hand-drawn illustration. I think I was one of the last generations of people trained that to consider advertising a possibility, you know, because we had drafting skills. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been a piece of hand-drawn advertising in recent memory. So all of this stuff is a kind of, again, you know, it has that kind of nostalgic, you know, teary-eyed goodbye, not unlike what you're talking about, you know, that is, there is a history, we should know about it. One of the problems with globalization, and this has become cliched at this point, is that if you're a member of any group that has more than two people, you're seen as the oppressor. So nobody can partake of any kind of legacy because you'll be seen as xenophobic. Not an uninteresting question, but one that I avoid by taking territory that really nobody would touch. Not that nobody has touched, nobody would touch it. I mean, this stuff has the, what I call the stink of herring about it. You know, it's It's echt Jewish. And I thought, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, when I started B'nai Yosef, Mel Brooks came out with Blazing Saddles. And Blazing Saddles is just peppered with Yiddishisms. And for the poster on Blazing Saddles is Mel Brooks in profile with a feathered headdress on, and in beadwork in his feathered headdress, it says in Hebrew, kosher lePesach, kosher for Passover. And I'm thinking, this is bananas, because, you know, blonde, beautiful, blue-eyed Protestant people in the Midwest think this film is funny. You know, that's amazing. So that I also remember seeing on YouTube, which is more recent, is sort of, you know, post 613 vindication, that on the Kate Smith TV show in 1952, you can find this on YouTube, I found it, Kate Smith TV show, she had Myron Cohn on doing a 5-minute shtick in a thick Yiddish accent. I'm thinking, this is the height of the McCarthy era. This is Kate Smith, Myron Cohn? He says, a chicken is walking in the street, and then I'm thinking, who's watching this? And why do they think this is funny? So I realized there was, in fact, a permission for me to enter into this, which was simply undocumented because Jewish historians don't want to acknowledge this, you know, unless they're comic historians. And non-Jewish historians, quite frankly, don't have any interest, and why should they? So I figured, well, you know, it's open. I recognize that it's there. If Myron Cohn was on Kate Smith in 1952, I can do the 613.
And can I ask you a technical question about your colors?
Sure.
Okay. I noticed in one of your essays you mentioned that you had custom acrylic resins made. Can you explain how that contributes to your color?
Sure. Well, there's two things about the color. The first is every artist of my generation who was working in the faster levels of I was a studio assistant to a bunch of hotshot painters when I was a teenager. I was like 16, I'm working for Larry Poons, and we used to go to Frank Stella's house and Jules Zelitsky. And at that time, acrylic paint was just becoming popular. So every painter took it upon themselves, the way people understood certain recipes about oil paint, to learn the chemistry of acrylic paint. I don't know if that's necessary anymore or if it's desirable, but everyone of that era, of the mid-60s, learned all about the chemistry, about the pH and the acids and the polymers and, you know, different kinds of pigment dispersions and stuff. And I got used to making my own stuff. Now, as far as the colors go, the original painting, the 613, that these images are taken from, is actually one painting, and it's made up of components. There are 614 contiguous panels. And when I hung them in the warehouse, it was 17 feet high and 100 feet long, one painting. And they all have these gold frames around them, I mean gold, you know, painted gold. And the point was, when any light would hit it, the gold would reflect and this kind of golden glow would come off it. And the interiors of the paintings were painted kind of matte because I was trying to emulate a kind of Masaccio-type fresco, thinking this was a religious wall. However, when the opportunity for the book came up, I realized that the book isn't a painting. I didn't quote this here, but I read in The New Yorker, there's this wonderful anecdote. The wonderful novelist Richard Price had written a book called Lush Life, and some galleries in the Lower East Side decided to put on a show that would reflect artists' response to Richard Price's book, Lush Life, and they had like a 5-gallery show. This is about 4 or 5 years ago. And the columnist for The New Yorker is walking around with Richard Price and says to Richard Price, do any of these paintings, do these shows reflect back to you something about your book, Lush Life? And he said, no, not at all. He said, however, just like you don't bring a knife to a gunfight, you don't bring a book to an art show. And I thought, wow, that's like a super, super cool line. I don't know where I was going with that, but I like that story.
The colors.
The colors, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm getting to that age, I admit it, you know? No. Is my hour up, doctor? So the colors are kind of matte, and when I realized it was a book, I said, well, the book is going to have things that the painting doesn't have. It's going to have every individual image isolated, and the painting doesn't have the text of the commandments underneath them. And since this is going to isolate each image and pair it with the text, it has to be interesting as a book. So the photographer and I actually keyed up the colors. So a lot of the garish colors, which I love because I kind of see Jewishness and garishness as being very compatible. As we think of all immigrant groups, somehow we've sort of kept it, you know. there's a poem by Moshe Leib Halpern where he talks about stomping into a room with muddy boots, and I keep thinking, oh yeah, that's me. You know? We keyed the colors up so that it would be an actual book. If I was going to be author of this book, and I figured, well, I can't really mess with this too much. My co-author is God, so I figured let me do justice by this and make it an interesting book. So I'm actually very pleased with how the colors got tweaked up. But the actual painting, a lot of the visual impact comes from the reflection off the gold because it's one piece. The painting will be shown again in San Francisco in about a year and a half or so. But in the meantime, the book is going to suffice on its own as an independent object.
So you think of it as the original warehouse display as a single painting and you said Masaccio
the wonderful Italian fresco painters that we all learned to love.
The
Byzantine stuff actually glows by itself because you have all those mosaics and all that gold stuff. And have you been to Monreale in Palermo? The entire inside of the church is in gold mosaic. It's mind-boggling. But I had seen that before I did this, and I thought, wow, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. So that all figures into it.
So if we could return to the issue about education, I mean, I think that the same things you're lamenting about art education can be seen in the writing programs, okay, the growth of these MA writing programs, which have absorbed ambitious young people and essentially homogenized them, standardized them, and also removed them from, having them in an academic setting, removed them from actual life experience, the very things that should feed fiction or poetry. Instead, they're in the hothouse environment of the MA programs.
The problem with life experience is that it's subjective, and that's the same problem that the academy now, the universities face, is that dealing with the subjective is just too much work for everybody. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get life experience, you're going to get term papers. And the term papers mm-hmm. need footnotes, and that means that things are going to rely on pre-existing information. And the same thing happens in the art schools. That is, somebody will come into your studio to crit your work, and what they'll say is, have you seen so-and-so? Have you looked at this? Your work looks like this. Why don't you do this? If you did this, you'd look like this. And what they're missing is this. I'm going to have to hold the mic in a funny way. Let's say they give you a pre-existent aesthetic. And this is just a problem with Chelsea in general, or the art market. Not that the art market cares what I say, but but this is what you see, which is why so many art students are bored walking around Chelsea. But Chelsea's not for art students anymore, it's for collectors. Right. And the collectors basically are not entrepreneurs who made their money, they're stock market people, they're lucky, and they don't have any experience with making hard decisions. They just got money in their pocket. But here's the problem, is that what makes it easy for academia now is to take a role model. So they'll say, well, here's the aesthetic. And if you try to reach that aesthetic and you don't, you're mediocre. If you hit that aesthetic, you're derivative. And if you go over that aesthetic, you're vulgar and garish. So actually, there's no point in having that role model to begin with, because there's nothing you can do but lose. But since you're only going to be in that program for 2 or 3 years, the administration doesn't care. They teach people that way, and then they come out, you know, scratching their heads and walking around, and they pile up like stacks of wood in Bushwick and Greenpoint and Williamsburg and Long Island City, all wondering why this education they got is all turning out exactly the same work for 7 miles of the Brooklyn waterfront. From Sunset Park to Long Island City, there's 200,000 artists, and they're all turning out grad school work, and they're wondering, like, you know, how to get out of it. And the way to get out of it is, you know, forget it, you know, just forget it.
Like in one of your essays, you mentioned that it's impossible with the present bureaucratic structure of the university to allow the kind of, you referred to a kind of a free and open discussion in the European manner, and I wonder what you meant by that.
Just the allowance for discourse. You don't get discourse. You get directives, and the major problem with that is that the terminal degree in a studio program is the MFA. So what you do is you treat somebody like some kind of subservient moron student for 2 years, and then, like in The Wizard of Oz, you give them a diploma. And say, now you've got a diploma, now go out and be a great artist. And they've been trained to be students, basically slaves. And they come out and they go, oh, I'm okay, I'm an artist now. let's see, if I do everything I was taught, well, if you do everything you're taught, you're doing everything everybody else was taught as well. So you end up with thousands of people with really their imagination amputated because they're told that, you know, for instance, there was a big fad in the 90s for like doing fairy tales. I mean, I don't know how many Alice in Wonderland projects there were, but I thought even your imagination now is curtailed to what's officially sanctioned. You can do Alice in Wonderland, you can do Snow White, but you can't actually think about something that occurs to you as being goofy because it's like that wonderful anecdote where somebody came up to Robert Creeley after a reading and said, is that a real poem or just something you made up? You know? True story. And that's what's actually happened. What used to be a joke is in fact what's happening in academia now, is that unless it's a real story, you can't make up anything. And if you can't make up anything after you get your diploma, you're trained to not make up anything and you end up with this stuff. And that's what the market's calling for. So in one sense, we can cry about it. You know, we can say, you know, oh, what happened to, you know, the great thinkers of the past and how come people aren't trained in having their imagination be articulated somehow or manifested either in their studio or their writing or whatever. And in the other sense, you see that people are lining up like lemmings to have this done to them. And, you know, the best we can do as educators is to take them aside. And when I lecture, I close the door. I make damn sure that my colleagues and everyone else doesn't hear what I'm saying. I mean it. And, you know, I say basically what I'm saying here tonight. But then they go out and somebody says to them, do this, do this, do this, look at this, look at this, go to this show, and then do one that's just like that. Or write a review of your own work. You know, once you're trained to become a viewer of your own work, you're paralyzed. You know, like you're watching yourself. Ooh, what am I doing? You know, so, and the whole notion of the Jungian sense of having some kind of water table, and Ben Shahn talks about this in his Harvard lectures, where he says, you know, if you do something specific, if you're told to do something, like use a certain symbol, use a certain political position, use a certain philosophical strategy, and then somehow illustrate or empathize with that, then you're doing something that's a received symbol, and it only has a certain amount of currency. But if you actually do something deeply, deeply, deeply personal, so personal that you think nobody will get it, and you plumb way down and you have the courage to actually articulate that, what you will find is that everybody has that. Everybody has that. And if you hit that groundwater, you know, then you're going to be doing something that's a little bit more permanent and a little bit more nourishing than simply giving people received information. And that received information, in fact, is what's being panned off as education now, which is, like I said, easy for the administrators, easy for the academicians, and a crime against education. However, all you can do about it is fight it individually. Like I said, you and I aren't the only people, thank goodness. I mean, I have Vito Acconci teaching in Brooklyn College. Thank God for Vito. Vito's nuts. I mean, I don't know what Vito's doing. He closes the door and shows movies from the 60s. I mean, as far as I know, he's showing like Kenneth Anger films. I figured, wow. Great, let him, you know.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know if
wow.
he is, but maybe he is, yeah. You know. I mean, I do. I show yeah. Stan Brakhage films in my class,
yeah.
and they've never seen it before. You know, like, wow,
yeah.
You know. But the thing is, I have to go back to Stan Brakhage, yeah. Because everything coming out of Hollywood, not everything. I shouldn't say that because I don't see movies. But I assume that most of the stuff that's coming out, it has 15 corporate rubber stamps on it. And by the time you're through with that, it's like, you know, it's like the old joke about the Italian post office. Dum, 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 dum. And there's really nothing left that's going to breathe.
Yeah, so. I mean, with the experimental film movement, okay, when we were in college, tremendous influence on me. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I saw Warhol's early films, which are the Warhol Foundation's dropping the ball. You can't find them anywhere. These had like an enormous liberating effect. I mean, and of course, there's so many interesting foreign films just made with fantastic cinematography and quality photography. You know, young people today have hardly ever seen a beautiful a great photograph. Okay.
One of the reasons you don't see the Warhol films is because some of them are naughty. And that is, I mean it. And if they started to promulgate Andy Warhol as a filmmaker, you know, they would be subject to the kind of academic censorship which crosses the lines of political correctness. You know, and I don't want to sound like Donald Trump, but in fact it's true. There are certain things you just don't talk about. And meanwhile, academia sees itself as this open, porous discourse. That's a bunch of baloney.
Yeah.
It's not. But speaking of film, the reason that I could work serially is because I majored in animation when I was in college, and the films of Stan Brakhage were incredibly influential on me on the notion of rapid sequence. And I thought, oh, you can work sequentially, and it somehow makes its own relentless narrative. So despite the fact that I was brought up to, you know, adore William Carlos Williams and bebop and it's Kid Brother Bluegrass. I found myself gravitating towards people who were exiled from the jazz community, like Cecil Taylor or John Ashbery, people whose notion of the relentless, continuous, synced up very clearly with my understanding that there was a narrative, in fact, in Stan Brakhage's work. And that narrative could not necessarily be articulated the way a fairy tale could, but that narrative, in fact, was something that went beyond the verbal, but we all understood it, which is why he, in fact, had an audience. That kind of thing can't be taught. You can expose people to it, and if they get it, that's great, but then you can't reinvest that back into a discourse because the syllabus is not going to accommodate it because the syllabus is fixed.
The problem with the fixed syllabus, I mean, do you have strong feeling? I believe in a flexible syllabus, right? And I'm following from Milton Kessler, who was poet who was my great teacher, and I object to the prefab syllabus. Okay, I think that's one of the atrocities of contemporary education.
I'm told by not only my present administration, but all college administrations, that I have to present a syllabus to the class, and at the end of the class, at the end of the session, they will have to sign a form saying I showed them the syllabus. And this is what I do. I walk in the first day of class. I don't say a word. I do this in all my classes. So if any of you are about to take my class, this is what you can expect. I walk in the first day of class, and I take out a legal pad. I don't say a word. And I start drawing a picture. And I draw a picture of a very large vehicle with two wheels and a front and somebody sitting in the driver's seat and about 15 heads coming out of the windows doing this, and I write under it, S-I-L-L-Y, new word, B-U-S, syllabus. And I say, okay, you can be asked whether I showed you the syllabus. This is a syllabus. Now you've seen it, and now let's go on with the semester. All right.
I personally believe that every class, especially in an art school, okay, has its own dynamic, the own personalities, and that the teacher should be trained to respond to that. So I feel that this is the large subject of the semester, and now I'll see. It's almost like jazz. I mean, it's an improvisation. You're reacting to what they need or what their personal interests are, and there's really very little room in today's bureaucratic educational system for this.
Yeah, you dropped the magic word. That once you have to say the word trained, you've already lost it. Yeah. That is, there are plenty of people with passion and enthusiasm who, in fact, are kept out of academia. I had a marvelous candidate for a position about 3 years ago at the place where I now work. And the dean told me that this person was not material because he talked too much. He had too much energy. And that was a legitimate reason to deny this person a position on the faculty. Philip Guston told me that Mark Rothko was fired from Brooklyn College by Ad Reinhardt because Reinhardt accused Rothko of spending too much time talking to the students. Mm. True story. Yeah. There's that wonderful story. In fact, now that I'm talking about Philip and Reinhardt, this is academia. Philip told me that he was on a panel once that Tom Hess was moderating. And on the panel was Philip Reinhardt and I guess three other luminaries at the time. And Reinhardt got up and he read his list, which goes on for four pages, of things that the artist can and can't do. The artist is this, the artist is this, the artist doesn't do this, the artist cannot do this, the artist must do this. And he just stood up and read this manifesto. And at the end of Reinhardt's reading this, there was dead silence in the auditorium, and the panel didn't know what to say. And Hess pushes the microphone over to Philip and says, well, Philip, you're going to have to break this silence. And Philip picks up the microphone, and he looks at Reinhardt and he says, the artist should not want to be right. And that's what we've lost, is that everyone's got to be right,
Archie, Camille, on that note, thank you so much. I'm right here on the front row.
I was hearing your voice bounce off the...
This has been a remarkable evening. Thank you so much for this brilliant, insightful discussion. And I'm so sorry we've run out of time.